Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys, or you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look us up, Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Today I have a wonderful, talented guest. Let me just tell you a little bit about her. First of all, she's the 15th president of Bennett College for Women. She's an economist, author, commentator. You might have seen her works in USA Today, Black Issues in Higher Education, Miss Magazine, Essence Magazine, and I could go on. You've also might have seen her on CNN, BET, PBS, NBC, so on and so forth. She currently serves on the boards of the Economic Policy Institute, the Recreation Wishlist Committee, the Liberian Education Trust. She's the founder of The Last Word Productions Incorporated. She does public speaking all across the country. And today we're going to be talking about her latest book, amongst many. This is not her only book, Surviving and Thriving, 365 Facts in Black Economics History. Good morning, Dr. Malvo.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for joining the call.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, let's just start off from the beginning, just a little bit about you, just to get the audience who are not familiar with you. You have a PhD in economics, and as an African-American woman, that is just in one sentence, you know, African-American woman, PhD in economics, you don't hear that very often. Why did you decide on economics, and why did you decide actually to go as far as getting your PhD? Because I remember hearing somewhere that you were a little tentative at first, but then someone kind of pushed you over like, yes, you should go to the next level.
Well, you know, education is a core value in my family, and whatever I was going to do, it was going to be a terminal degree. I kind of wanted to have a little more fun, live a little before doing the doctorate, but my great aunt, Annie Mae Randall, was like, you got to go for it. My mentor, Dr. Phyllis Wallace, who's mentioned in my latest book, was another one who's like, you got to go for it, and so I went for it. But with education being a core value, it would have been something terminal in any case. Economics is a study of who gets what, when, where, and why. And I've always been fascinated by how the knife cuts the pie. Law would have been the other possibility. I mean, I think my senior year in college, I applied for, like, law school, graduate school in journalism, political science, psychology. My interests were all over the place. And the funny thing is that when I look back, I mean, this is, you know, 30 years later, 30-some years later, you look back and my interests are still all over the place, but somehow I managed to locate them under the broad umbrella of economics and education, which, of course, are my first loves.
One of the things I was reading, the challenges that you faced when you first went up to Boston was the incident in South Boston with walking into a bar, being basically told to leave and escorted by the police and told never to come back to South Boston. Talk to the audience a little bit about that.
Well, Boston was just one of the most racist places in the world. And, you know, if you stayed on your campus, you would be okay. I was at Boston College if I stayed on campus. But I was one of these hard-headed young people. I had relatives in Boston, so my mom said, you know, you get to Boston, you wait for your relatives at the airport. Well, they were late, and I'm impatient. Some misunderstanding. I'm impatient. So the next thing you know, I've rented a car. And back in the day, you know, kids could rent cars. I mean, you have to be 25, but back then, you know, you could get away with it. I had a driver's license and a credit card, so I rented a car. And I thought, okay, I'll just take myself to campus and figure it out later. But I got lost. And people who are familiar with Boston will know there's a way that coming out of the airport, you can end up in South Boston as opposed to on Commonwealth Avenue, which is a main drag. So I ended up in South Boston, and the people were not nice to me. But that's South Boston. I mean, you had a woman who was on the school board in South Boston who said black children will be bussed there over her dead body. I'm like, okay, give me what I really want. but unfortunately, when I look back, it didn't teach me any lessons. one might say, okay, well, did you learn patience? Did you learn, you know, to pay attention? The answer would be no.
No. You're like, no, I didn't learn it.
But it was an interesting introduction to Boston.
Now, earlier you mentioned about your mentors, and I think that's so important. I mention about mentors a lot on the show. I actually ask people to step up to be mentors because people, I feel, complain a lot about the young people, but I always say, what are you doing to help them? And then even as an adult in your life, sometimes you need a mentor to know which way to go. You mentioned Dr. Phyllis Ann Wallace. Tell the audience a little bit about her.
Well, Dr. Phyllis Wallace was from Baltimore, Maryland. She basically, her story is really funny because she decided that she didn't want to go to an HBCU. In the state of Maryland, the state would actually pay you to go to a majority college if you want to major in something that they did not offer at an HBCU. And at
okay.
the time, Coppin and Morgan did not have an econ major. So she picked the econ major, and the city and the state of Maryland sent her, actually paid her to go to New York University. I mean, this is how
wow.
segregation is that they will pay you to leave the state. And she wasn't the only one. I mean, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of African Americans in Alabama and Mississippi and other places where under the guise of separate but equal, the definition of separate but equal was I'll pay you to leave the state.
Like, get out of here.
Get out of Dodge. Exactly. So anyway, she did go to NYU, and then she went on to Yale. She was the first African-American woman to get a Ph.D. in economics from Yale, and she did that in 1946. And just was a phenomenal woman who had this amazing career that included being the first research director of EEOC, included working with Ken Clark, you know, who did the doll studies. She
mm-hmm.
did a book with him called Pathways to Work, which was about how young African-American women in the late 60s found occupational satisfaction. And the job at that time, it was post-segregation but not yet full integration. So the job that was seen as kind of like the bridge job was a retail sales clerk. That was a big
I did a lot of retail. I've done a lot of retail in my life, trust me.
Well, you know, but if, think about it in 1966. I mean, that was a job that black women didn't have. You know,
mm-hmm.
we basically were maids. You know,
70%
right. of us at that time, you know, household workers, you know, if we were professional, we were teachers, nurses, or social workers. So, you know, she basically studied how young girls decided what they wanted to do and what that meant. And then she came to MIT, and when she came to MIT, she, you know, was the first African-American woman on the faculty there, actually. She was in the business school, not in the econ department, but she put her hands around, there was another sister, Linda Datcher, and myself, who were in the econ department, and she put her hands around us and made sure that we had the kind of professional opportunities that we ought to have and really just sort of nurtured us and fed us. And I always call her my intellectual mother. You know, I have a mother who is my total mother, but then this woman really got me, got my brain, and it was always kind of interesting because she much more conservative in a lot of ways, different kind of presentation, but had my back completely, just utterly completely.
But that's important, I think, when you're traveling into, you know, unknown territory and maybe in an environment that is not as welcoming as you would hope, to have a mentor somewhere there to guide you, to give you strength. I mean, do you feel like she gave you strength to help
oh,
go
yes,
on?
Oh,
yes,
and courage and purpose and, you know, just lots of things. I can't
yes.
even begin to, I mean, and she was my friend. I mean, she wasn't, you know, you have some mentors. I've had all kind of mentors in my life. I'm very blessed that people have put their hands around me. But you have some that you don't really feel are that approachable. You know, you just,
mm-hmm.
there's some stuff you won't talk to them about.
Purely business, you said, yeah.
We would talk about almost anything. And, you know,
well,
I
that's
mean,
great.
She passed in 1993. And, you know, I miss her every day, she has friends who stay connected with me, and some of them crack me up because they'll say things like, well, you know, Phyllis will be so happy that you're, you know, doing higher education. Because for the longest time, I really kind of resisted doing higher education in the straight way. In other words,
yes.
you know, I mean, being a college president is about as straight as it gets.
I was about to say, but you took a lot of other roads in between with your other works and stuff.
Exactly. And just was always sort of like, you know, the rebel, the sister outsider, and sort of gleefully so. And so...
You said sort of gleefully so. Let's talk about that a little bit, being an outsider. In one of your interviews you did recently this year, you were talking about being a woman and how you were asked to dumb down yourself, and that would maybe give you some more opportunities. And this is from one of your male cohorts. How did that make you feel, and what can you tell women who are in higher education or in high-level positions? What can you tell them to help combat that or deal with that kind of stress? That's a stress, knowing that people want you to fail or look stupid somehow.
Well, you know,
how do you deal with it?
The context was that it was a producer who basically felt that he would not put me up against certain white men in debates because I would always beat him. And he says, well, how does this look? It's not a fair fight. You know, you need to dumb down and cute up. Those things got dumbed down and cute up. Well, I think I'm pretty cute anyway. So, I mean, I'm sure. Yeah. Although not conventionally. So, I mean, I had another producer once ask me if I could grow hair. And I'm like, hair growth is a
they
human function.
They ask you if you could grow hair? What
right.
kind of question is that?
Well, I mean, hair growth is a human function. I choose to have a short afro. So,
yes.
You know, this is a choice. It's not like a medical disability. Well, people,
absolutely,
you know,
ridiculous.
People will ask you just, you know, television is the art of visual, and
mm-hmm.
people want to project certain kind of visuals. Now, when I was told to dumb down, I never even considered it. And even after, I was like, no. I mean, so, because you have to be you. I mean, I think the lesson, the recurrent lesson that we get in life, I mean, we'll get many, but the recurrent lesson for me is, you got to be you. You know, you can't
yes.
make chicken salad out of chicken spit. You simply can't do it.
Well, you have to be you because you, I think, everybody has unique gifts and talents. And if you try to be somebody else, we may lose some cure to cancer. We may lose a wonderful book that you wrote, this book, if you didn't choose the path that you chose. And talking about the book, I want to read a couple of the stories and people that you mentioned in the book. A lot of times when people think about blacks and economics, people think about Oprah. They think about Madam C.J. Walker. They think about, like, basketball stars and certain things. There's a lot of people they may not be aware of. A lot of children may not be aware of. So let me just read a couple of stories here. One of the people you start talking about, Free Frank McWhorter, founded New Philadelphia, Illinois in 1836, and the town was platted in 1840. He was the first African-American to be the founder of a town. He earned money for the land by establishing an extractive mining operation while he was still enslaved. I want to read that again. He earned money for the land by establishing an extractive mining operation while he was still enslaved. So he was not free yet. McWhorter, known as Free Frank because he had purchased his own freedom, owned property valued at about $2,600. His real property, 560 acres, was valued about $2,300. This was in the early 1800s. With the money Free Frank earned by selling town lots and other business opportunities, he eventually purchased freedom for 16 family members. In contrast to some all-black towns founded after the Civil War, where blacks purchased town lots from whites, whites actually purchased New Philadelphia town lots from Free Frank. And that's a wonderful story. And also, one of the key words there, I think, is enslaved. I mean, we're free now, Dr. Malvo. We're free as African Americans to walk around in most places in the United States, to use the bathrooms, to drink from the water fountains, to go to schools, you know, such as Bennett College or such as MIT, such as University of Penn. What is stopping us? Are we enslaved mentally? Is that what's stopping our economic parity? Talk to me about that.
Well, economic parity is going to be elusive because economic parity starts at the foundation. The foundation was we used to be somebody else's property. And so
mm-hmm.
when you look at how do you close the wealth gap, for example, it's almost impossible. At the same time, we could be doing a lot better than we are, and I do think that there's a measure of internal enslavement that we basically have embraced. Some of us who will not, do not, cannot do better, will not, do not, cannot save, will not, do not, cannot invest in each other. You know, the white man's ice is always colder. But we still have people of African descent who believe that, who feel that way. I was just with a sister the other day, had a little nasal ailment. I said, well, I've got to go see my doctor. And she sort of said, well, you know, I go to da-da-da. I said, well, you know, I go to a sister. I go to a sister, too,
and I've referred several people, black and white, to her, and they love her, and she's won awards. But, you know, that's not why I went to her. I went to her because she's interested in my health and helping me, you know.
Well, my thing with merchants is always I look for black first. I'm going to go best. I'm going to go best, especially when it has to do with my health. I'm going to go best. But I do believe that best can be black, and best often is. And
this sister
just kind of said to me, she says, well, you know, I don't know about that. She goes to someone, you know, a Caucasian person. I said, well, you know, different strokes for different folks. But I was surprised that someone who I thought was fairly conscious in the 21st century would actually posit that it didn't make sense to go to a black doctor. So, we could do a lot if we support each other. We support ourselves. We support each other. Oftentimes we don't. And so that's part of our challenge, our issue, and our problem. But I would just say that there is a level of self-enslavement, there is a level of self-hate that exists among us and in our community that we really have to combat, pay attention to, look at. You know, we have almost everything we need in our community. We don't have economic equality, but we have lots of other stuff. And we have a lot to build on. And I find that, you know, this whole post-racial conversation that people are having is silly, and it's inappropriate, and it really does not speak to where we are.
Well, I want to talk to you. Let me just read a little another example of one of the entrepreneurs in your book here. This is Elizabeth Keckley, primarily known as Mary Todd Lincoln's dressmaker. Elizabeth Keckley also owned the largest custom dressmaking business in Washington, D.C. She moved to the city in 1860 and quickly became most sought-after modist. In addition to making clothing for the First Lady, she designed dresses for the wives of Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. Because of her semi-celebrity status, Keckley used her connections to create the Contraband Relief Association, a nonprofit organization that helped disadvantaged African Americans. And I wanted to read that because your comments about us working together and being stronger that way, I mean, this is an example. That was the late 1800s of a woman and an African American doing just that. And what is stopping us from working together? Is it our ego that we want to be the best and we think if we get in a group we're going to be less than best? Why the resistance?
I think that it's trained, trained inferiority. It's you know, something that is put in our heads. It's a lack of knowledge. I mean, Susan Taylor just has come out. She and her team have come out with this New Way Forward manual, which I think is just brilliant and phenomenal. It really talks about what we need to do to heal our community. And I think that that's a lot of what we need to do is to really look at our community and to understand and embrace us and to say, okay, you know, the biggest challenge really is not to deal with racism, but to deal with ourselves.
Now, let me just get some fun stuff. We've been talking a lot of serious stuff. Some people may not know you were in a dance troupe.
Yeah, back in the day.
Talk to us a little bit about that experience. This is a great economist, but you're a dancer.
I actually truly at some place in my little bitty soul believed that I was going to be a professional dancer. I've been a poet. I have been a poet. I don't write poetry anymore, but I wrote it. Yeah, we all did back in the late 60s, early 70s. We all wanted to be Giovanni. I had some of my poetry published, and then I was dancing with this troupe, and I thought I was good, but frankly, I wasn't. And so, you know, the group was going to Broadway, and I thought I was going, but they didn't ask me. I went to MIT. I told the professors, I'm like, you know, I'm going to drop out of school because I think I'm going to Broadway, and they all looked at me and just laughed because you could see when I walked down the hall that I didn't have but so much rhythm. But they were like, okay, let's let this woman have her delusions. And I went back to the guy and said, you know, I've decided I'm going to drop out of school. And he said, Miss Malvo, you'd be a much better economist than you would a dancer.
Well,
and I think I cried for about 3 days, but he was right, you know. And
you cried about 3 days about it? You strong?
I had my heart set on, you know, being in the middle of the stage.
Yes. From the chat room, I've had some questions from the chat room here. They're just talking about the current economic situation in terms of what. Let's get your opinion about the bailout. Do you feel that what the government did in bailing out the different companies helped us or hurt us, or it was null and void to the general population?
I think it helped more than it hurt, but I think it was unfair and it should have been done differently. I think that when Henry Paulson went to Mr. Bush and said, gee, we need all this money, there were harder questions that needed to be asked. They weren't asked. And so what ended up happening is that, you know, a lot of people got a grant at taxpayer expense. That's the same kind of grant that I know there are lots of people listening they'd like to have. Bail me out.
Definitely. I like to have that. I like to have a bailout.
So, you know, there's some real challenges in terms of the way this was done. And I think there's some real, there's real challenges in terms of the way this was done. And I think it was done the wrong way. President Obama didn't do it. Unfortunately, he's now being blamed for some of it. And what he did do with the legislation that was signed yesterday was to do a round two by allowing the Bush tax cuts to stay. I think if I were talking to his economists, they would say, well, it was justified because we needed to, and you fill in the blanks, you know, we needed to get the unemployment insurance. But at what price? I mean, I think the unemployment insurance will have cost us about $50 billion, whereas keeping the Bush tax cuts permanent probably is going to cost several hundred billion dollars. So,
yes.
You know, it's a really... The economics of this time are exacerbated by the fact that no one's fighting for little guys.
People are mad because they're like you said, well, I didn't get anything. This hasn't changed my life in any way, shape, or form. That's tangible. You know, that's one of the reasons that people don't vote, is because they feel like there's no tangible gain from voting. Unfortunately, they're not aware that most people don't vote. If everybody voted, you know, at least 80%, which never rarely happens, then there would be a difference. But there's no tangible thing that can't touch and feel.
People are feeling very betrayed. The American people are feeling very betrayed. They're feeling that no one is responding to them. I think that the president has good intentions. I think that some of the people around him are the wrong people. And I think that that's really problematic. I also just feel that, you know, we're not – employment is the most important thing. It's what keeps our country together.
Well, I'm definitely a nationalist on that and creating jobs here, and I feel like a lot of people have the concern of jobs being created overseas in other areas and not here for the American public. One of your interviews, you talked about the situation in Detroit and how they were very dependent on the auto industry. You know, that's a big issue. But that goes back to education, I think, too, Dr. Malvo.
Well, education is at the center of all of this. And that's the thing that we have to keep remembering. Education is so important. It has the power to transform lives. And so why is it so expensive still, you know, to educate people? I mean, people always say, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Well, that's what we're trying right now. So we see other countries really investing a lot more in education than we are, and that's really problematic.
So as becoming a president of a college, how do you attract students and how do you keep students? Because a lot of times people get into college and maybe because of that financial issue they have to drop out. What are some things that Bennett College is doing to help women get into college and stay in college, go through?
Well, you know, my job is to raise money. My job is to find money for student financial aid, to find money for new projects on campus. We've got 3 new buildings in the last year and have one more coming in February. Thanks to a great team that works with me, we've been able to do that. But the real big challenge for me now is to find money for financial aid, because you have young people who come. Sometimes they come in circumstances where their parents had money, and then they don't have money because of this economy. You know,
yeah.
I think in the last 2 weeks, I've seen 3 sets of parents where one guy has gone bankrupt. He had a really great business just 2 years ago. And so, you know, what do we do with his daughter? She's a good student. We've got to try to find the money. But, you know, I once wrote a column back in the late 80s, and I said everybody should be able to go to school for free. So then I become the president of Bennett. And the lady sent me a letter with a column and says, you know, my daughter owes all this money, but you said everybody should go to school for free.
Uh-oh.
So I had to write it back to the sister. When I was a pundit, I spoke as a pundit. And as a president,
right.
I have to look at salaries, you know, how to keep the lights on, all that good stuff. So it's a whole different story. I do wish that we could all go to school for free. I wish that the same kind of consideration that's being given to billionaires will be given to college students. The Pell Grant, President Obama has raised it, so it's $5,350. But, you know, tuition, room, and board at Bennett is about $25,000. So $5,350 leaves the student looking for another $19,000.
Right. Let's just talk about your company, Last Word Productions. People are listening this morning. If you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Dr. Julianne Malveau. She's the president, 15th president of Bennett College. She's an author of several books, and her most recent book, Surviving and Thriving, talking about black economic history. You can purchase it at lastwordproductions.com. Again, lastwordprod.com. Now, you decided to distribute this book through Last Word. Why did you decide that? What was the reasoning, not like working with other, like Amazon or things of that, groups of that nature?
Well, I decided to do two things. First of all, I decided to self-publish the book, which was not my choice. Many of us who are published authors, and I've been published by, you know, mainstream press in the past, look at self-publishing and say, eh, that means nobody would buy your book. But what does it mean that nobody will buy your book? It means that they didn't think that what you had to say was that important or that they could get a market for it. Well, no, people don't want people to know about black economic history, so no, we couldn't get a market for it. But I felt strong enough about it, and I was working with a young brother, Patrick Oliver, and Patrick said, you know, Doc, do it yourself. You have the means, do it yourself. And so I tell people all the time that surviving and thriving is a love note to my people. It's what I want my people to know about our history. And so I do hope, obviously, it's an entrepreneurial endeavor. I do hope that it'll make money, but I'll be cool if it doesn't because it's something that needs to be out there. Secondly, to distribute it ourselves, and we may, you know, reconsider the decision. This is all a work in progress. Amazon.com takes the first 55% off the top. And what
we
stores take 40%. So 55% off the top does not leave you a lot of wiggle room for profit possibilities.
Yeah, and you're an economist, so you're thinking, you know, I'm trying to make money also, you know.
I'm like 55%, give me a break. So, you know, it may well be, and a lot of folks have said, well, you may want to reconsider that because, you know, someone's listening to your show, going to Last Word, whereas they go to Amazon, you know, maybe quicker, they can do it right away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we understand that. We understand that, and it's, as I said, it's my own econ lesson. When it's over with,
right.
I will probably write something. In fact, a couple of people have asked me, a couple of bookstore owners have asked me to write about self-publishing because I think that when people don't think about self-publishing with all its pitfalls. There's a lot of books out there, you know, we call them ghetto lit, these stories, and they're poorly written, frankly. I hate to say that, but I get them over my transom all the time with every other page with typos on them. And
right.
when I look
so there's
at
a lot
them
of
now,
things that people could help learn from that. So I think you should write the book because people will definitely listen to you. They respect your opinion, and it will help a lot of people. We have about 1 minute left. I just want to ask you a couple quick questions. What's your favorite musician?
Probably John Legend right now, but I switch up every other day.
What's the last book you read recently?
I got to run upstairs and tell you because it's such a good book. It's called Parallel Lives by Adele Logan Alexander, and it's about this brother who was an ambassador back in the turn of the century. And I just finished it this morning, and it was like, I'm addicted to the printed word. So people always say to me, how do you find time to read? I'm like, I find time.
You find time. All right, and what do you think you're going to eat for dinner tonight?
Oh, gee, I'm going to some dinner dance. It'll probably be the usual, you know, chicken and beef or chicken and fish or something. Who knows? I'm going to enjoy my salad. I'm not a big meat person, so I'm looking forward to a salad and, you know, all that good stuff.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Malveau, for coming on this morning. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule, constantly doing things. Like people said, how do you have time to read? But I thank you so much for coming on, and I thank the listeners for listening this morning. If you're just tuning in again, just speaking with Dr. Julianne Malveau, you want to check out her book, Surviving and Thriving. And if you want to win a free copy of the book, you can email me at Saturdays with Joy Keys. Email me the birth date of Madam C.J. Walker. Email me the birth date of Madam C.J. Walker, and you can win a free copy of Dr. Malveau's book. Thank you so much, Dr. Malveau, for coming
on. Thank you, Joy, and thanks for the work you do and keeping that word out there. We appreciate you, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. You have a good one.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeys. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look me up at Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, you can stay tuned because I'm going to be speaking with journalist and author Linda Pohlman live from Holland, so stay tuned. Have a wonderful Saturday.